ball is high, it is far, it is gone to win the game.
The Mets are on their way back.
World champions for the 27th time.
Home plate for all things Major League Baseball. This is the Nosebleeds Podcast on WFUV Sports.
Welcome back to another edition of Nosebleeds, WFUV Sports' exclusive Major League Baseball podcast. How's it going, everybody? Will Talent alongside Lou Orlando and Evan Harkin. It's a beat reporter, Nosebleeds, this time around. Me and Lou on Yanks, Evan on the Mets. So a lot of active baseball going on. All three of us in attendance for some of the most recent home games for both of the local squads. Lou going to the onslaught, yeah. I guess is the word to say, of the day of recording's game. The Yankees, we'll get into them in just a second. There's no need to get into them right now. I'm still letting it marinate. That was a colossal waste of my time and maybe a little bit more of a waste of your time, Lou. But first and foremost, how are you guys doing today?
Oh, man, I'm pumped to be here. We got a great crew. And it's been a minute since I've been on Nosebleeds. And just being locked into all the hockey stuff, it's been a weird vibe where all of a sudden I'm thrust into late May and then early June baseball, and you get a Red Sox series, you get an Orioles series, you got a Braves series coming up for the Yanks. It's I found that now I'm dialed in. Before, I don't think I was as locked in as I needed to be. Now I'm like, I'm feeling the feels, the good and the bad, and I was worried that wasn't there for a little bit, so I'm glad to start caring again, because last season, Will, we've talked about this. Last season hurt me, but now I'm feeling the feels again. We're back.
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good too as a Yankee fan. Not too good today after that beatdown I had to watch earlier. It was terrible watching it with friends that are Mets fans or fans of other teams in general. But as a Mets beat reporter, like you mentioned, Will, it's been pretty good lately, especially because, not to toot my own horn, but on last week's Nosebleeds, I was saying the Mets are going to get hot. So something's coming. I could feel it. And it did, with a little help from Grimace, a little bit of help out there. But pretty good overall. Been really hot here lately in New York too, which I don't mind. I like the hot weather, get a little sweat going, get a little pool and beach going. So all good all around here.
Yeah, we're flipping the calendar. It's going to be the first day of summer. If it's not already today, I never really know. But it's usually this one. It is today. God bless. Happy summer, everyone. And that's when we really roll into baseball. That's when things start to get a little dicey. But before we get into the action, a little bit of a somber opening note. The passing of Willie Mays happened yesterday, actually, or 2 days ago. Today's Thursday. It was on Tuesday morning. It was announced Tuesday night. Very, very sad. 93 years old, lived a long and fulfilling life. A two-time MVP, a 24-time All-Star, the 1954 World Series champion to go along with 12 gold gloves, a Hall of Famer, and much more to unpack with the great Willie Mays, above and beyond human being, as it is a trailblazer in that regard as well for the work that he's done for equality amongst Major League Baseball. And on top of it all, truly, if not the one of the greatest baseball players we have ever seen from top to bottom, a true five-tool Major League Baseball player, and not just five-tool, but a five-tool player that specifically excelled at every single aspect of those tools. Willie Mays, Lou, left quite the legacy for Major League Baseball. Fulfilled life, but still very sad day for Major League Baseball.
I mean, simply put, right, it's a baseball great. I think you hear the expression, you can't tell the story of the game without this person. And I think that probably applies more than to most people than to Willie Mays, right? If there are 10 people that you can't tell the story of baseball without, Willie Mays is one of those 10. He might be one of the five that you can't tell the story of baseball without. Just a staple of the game. I think probably one of the last remaining remnants of a very special time, like the 1950s era of baseball that gets glorified. And especially for us in New York, like he's in his prime when you have the three New York teams and those connections run deep, right? Like when he's with the New York Giants, he ends his career with the New York Mets. He's playing center field in the 73 World Series, even though they lose. Like, so he's a big staple of New York baseball, and he's a big staple nationwide, because I think you talk to a lot of people that either they were alive and they watched him play, or they listened to what their parents told them, what their grandparents told them. There are a lot of people that say he's the best baseball player I ever saw. And that's, I think, not something that you can take lightly. Like, his greatness is going to be remembered forever. And so, yeah, it's a sad loss, but I think anytime you lose a guy, a person like this, that's a staple of the sport, in a weird way, I think it's cool because it gives you an opportunity to look back at all the iconic moments. And for a week now, right, the entire baseball world's going to be talking about Willie Mays, and deservedly so. And that is the upside. That is the bright side of this, is that for a week, everyone's going to talk about and remember Willie Mays and his greatness.
Yeah, Willie Mays, for me, I feel like it's more the person he was and the persona he was, even with being the biggest star in baseball at the time, one of the best baseball players ever. Now, I think the stats are important if you don't know them. He had 660 home runs. That's sixth. He had over 300 batting average for his career, over 800 OPS. Like you said, more All-Star games than years any of us have been alive, which is insane to think about. But I was watching the Mets game where Keith Hernandez ended up crying on the air immediately when Willie Mays was mentioned. And he was just saying how Willie Mays was Willie Mays and not a star whenever people met him, that he didn't let the fame get to his head. He treated everybody the way he would have treated them as a 15-year-old kid when he was a 40-year-old megastar in the MLB. So I think just having so many players that were great in statistic ways, but kind of failed to show that in personal ways, with personal issues, gambling, off-field issues like that, you really saw nothing out of that from Willie Mays, and was just an overall great human to go with being an overall great baseball player.
Yeah, an exemplary human being at that, absolutely. He will be dearly missed. The Say Hey Kid, there's a reason he had that nickname. And as you were saying, Evan, he treated everyone as they were to him. He was, everyone was who they were. He never treated someone more or less. He was just an excellent, excellent human being and an unbelievable baseball player. Played the game hard, played it like a kid. He played the kid's game. That's why he is the Say Hey Kid. Willie will be missed. And as you said too, Evan, 660 home runs to go along with 1,900 RBIs in just about 3,300 hits, well above or well on top of those leaderboards in all of those categories for hits, home runs, RBIs. Had a lot of stolen bases as well, over 300. So once again, one of the more complete baseball players that we've seen and that we may ever see, and may he rest in peace. But now let's move in to our locals, and we'll start with the Yankees. The Yankees kind of showing some true colors, maybe, want to put it that way. Maybe a little bit better way to put it, some flaws, some evident flaws in this team that is still the leading record holder in Major League Baseball, but we're coming around that time of the year where trades are going to be speculated until the deadline passes. And it's looking like the Yankees are going to have to make some trades, especially with the injury bug that has been going around. Ian Hamilton, he goes down. He's out for however long now. It's the second time that he is out. Anthony Rizzo fractures his arm. He's going to be out until at least August. I would even go out on a limb and say probably September. Hard injury to come back from. Had a huge concussion injury last year. And you want Anthony Rizzo back at any capacity, you got to let him heal. He's 34 years old now, and we'll see how long that takes. John Birdie on the 60-day IL, which has been in effect for quite some time now. But another guy that's, you know, not a starter, but seriously important to this team and what they need in terms of depth. Now they're going to have to go out and get a John Birdie-esque guy on top of some bullpen help. They went out and signed Tim Hill today, who actually pitched for the Yankees. So lefty relief pitcher, side armor. They can use all the help they can get. But Lou, you were there today, and we'll talk about today's game specifically in just a moment. But in terms of the injury bug for the Yankees, where should they pivot to? What is going on? How can the Yankees patch these holes?
I'm still big on, and I know that you are too, relief pitching. Because I think as soon as Loaisiga went down, even before Loaisiga went down, I think the two of us looked at this bullpen. We saw it on the season preview show and we went, this bullpen's a little thinner than we've been accustomed to in a lot of previous seasons. And then Loaisiga goes down week one and you go, now we definitely need a major arm. And I know that, you know, F. Ross is close to coming back. You hear, I think Trevino, Lou Trevino might be ramping up as well. Neither of those guys, I don't, F. Ross hasn't pitched in a year. It feels like I haven't seen Trevino in a while as well. So you have no idea what that's going to look like. I think they'd both be solid arms when you get them back. I think you're going to need relief options because if you want to talk about today's game a little bit, well, the bullpen lets up 10 runs. And yeah, you were already down 7 runs and then Glaber cut it to a 6-run deficit. You're already down by a pretty large number where maybe it doesn't matter that the bullpen lets up a lot of runs today. But it's not just today, right? It's been the past couple of weeks that the bullpens look pretty shaky. I think you don't really have a lefty down there that you trust. Like Caleb Ferguson had a rough day today. Victor Gonzalez had a rough day today. And they've had rough days consistently now. They don't look sharp. You don't really trust them, even in lefty lanes. So I think you need a lefty in this bullpen that you trust. And I think you need another high leverage guy. Probably not. Like, I don't think you're going to get anyone that is Clay Holmes or putting up Clay Holmes numbers. But it'd be nice to have a guy that you could slot between Luke Weaver and Clay Holmes. And, you know, you find out who's available closer to the deadline. The fact, you know, considering that 3 wildcard teams make it from each league and everything's so close, there aren't that many MLB teams above 500. Like, I'm not really sure who's going to be a seller and who's going to be a buyer just yet. So I think you need help relief pitching wise. And then I think you wonder about in the infield, because I know, Will, when you came over for dinner, we were talking last night about, like, maybe you need another backup infielder with a, you know, a smooth, good glove infielder, kind of what Adany Echevarria was for those late 2010s Yanks. And then now you have to think about, hey, do you need a first baseman? Because we're going to get some run from Ben Rice here. Is he going to be your starting first baseman come postseason time? I'm not really sure if it's DJ at first base, and that probably means that it's Oswaldo. Are you banking on Rizzo coming back? To me, there's a lot of questions there that I think it would be a big move to go out there and get a starting caliber infielder. But if you're in win now, if you think this is the year you're going to go for the series, why not make a big move? So I am kind of curious to see, like, I think there's a world here where they trade for a major third baseman or a major first baseman because it would take away a major question mark in the infield.
Yeah, my worries for the Yankees, and I think a lot of Yankee fans have just been growing and growing over the last few series. I mean, I took the Dodgers series as more of a wake-up call, and this is what the Yankees needed, and I was kind of happy to see it, that they could see, you know, Rizzo's been a problem, that relieving's been a problem. Okay, we didn't have Soto. We dropped 2 out of 3 to the Dodgers. That's fine. And then the Red Sox series happens, and now the catchers are a problem too. That's a big issue I kind of wanted to mention. We had 10-plus bases stolen on us in 2 games. I think maybe 10 in 1 game. It was awful to watch what the Red Sox were doing on the base paths. And the Yankees actually have a pitching staff made up of very good statistic pitchers that do not allow base stealers. So that just lets you know how poor mostly Jose Trevino, but also Austin Wells has been back there. And their numbers at the plate haven't been good either. I mean, Wells, 210, 2 home runs and 10 RBIs. And 124 ABs, those aren't even really major league numbers. Trevi, way better at the plate, 268 home runs, 25 RBIs, and 15 more at-bats. But what you're doing at the plate's got to make up for what you're not doing on the other end. And right now, the Yankees catchers are probably their biggest issue. And I love what you were saying about the relievers, Will. I really wanted to talk about that, but I feel like you hit every point on the nose, except for what I also wanted to say, which is Tim Hill is not the answer that the Yankees need. I know they were
probably not
and got Tim Hill, but Tim Hill has never been specifically a good pitcher in this league since he's been in it. He's had a +4.5 ERA. Right now he has a 5.8 ERA. He was not pitching well for the White Sox. I know he needed a left-handed reliever, a lefty specialist, since Wandy Peralta left. It hasn't even really been since Loaisiga went down. That just adds another issue. So the issue is kind of starting to ramp up for the Yankees and make them not look like a super team, which makes me happy in a way because it shows them that they need to revamp and need to retool, which they failed to do in 2022. But it really puts the pressure on them to actually do that. And the only ones balling out besides Soto and Judge, which we, of course, expected, is Stanton. We got to give him some love for being the guy that we've wanted him to be, that we've seen at times, but he's been really doing it this June. Hopefully he can keep it going, which he hasn't done in the past. So, I mean, the Yankees really on them to fix their issues right now.
I'll say this about the bullpen real quick, because it was something that Boone was asked about post-game. I want to say that it was Max Goodman asked them if you look at the last couple of weeks and how they've struggled and if that forces you to think about if you need changes or you need upgrades in the bullpen. And I think a lot of times you'll see Boone kind of deflect and go, we trust the guys, whatever, it's a bad rut. And he simply went, yeah, no, we're going to talk about it. And they've already optioned Ron Marinaccio down. And that's not like a major move or anything like that. But that answer to me kind of struck me as, like, I wonder if they really are going to take the bullpen struggle seriously. Because I will say the big thing, Brian Cashman bought himself a lot of time with Yankee fans, I think, by the way that he attacked this offseason and making the aggressive trade to get Soto, signing Verdugo, which ended up being a real big spark plug for them. And if that kind of aggressive mentality carries over to the trade deadline, I think you could see some major moves here. And I think that's something that Yankee fans could and should be excited about.
I think it's definitely something you have to anticipate, because this is a contract year for Aaron Boone. And with that in mind, you have to keep Cashman in mind. This year is all in. It's been all in since they went out and got Juan Soto. So if they don't do anything at the deadline, then I can confidently say you can kiss the World Series dreams goodbye, and we're on to the next season. And I'm very, very serious about that, because if nothing gets done again, they will not beat the teams that are behind them right now. That's for sure. I think the Cleveland Guardians make a big case, even though the Yankees won that series. I think a team like Cleveland could sneak up on them before they even play a team like the Orioles in the playoffs. I think the Royals, even though they just took 3 or 4 from them, a team that is scrappy enough that will take down the Yankees. There are teams out there that can beat the Yankees. They've already lost 2 series in a row to start this for this entire week so far, since the weekend. And not for nothing, but it's been against division rivals. They are seriously struggling against the Baltimore Orioles, and that is seriously concerning. We talked about in the season preview, Lou, about how Baltimore has a good shot of, you know, edging them in the American League East, and they have shown that they are better than them. They just are. They played them seven games already, and the Yankees have won 2 games. So it's it's going to come down to the wire, but the Yankees have some evident holes. The bullpen has been a concern since the very beginning, and now things are starting to compound on that. So there's moves to be made. Some guys that jump out to me: Ryan McMahon, I think, would make a great fit for this Yankees team. First and third, can play second base as well, adds a lot of versatility there. Brendan Donovan is another guy. St. Louis can play second base, can play third base, can play first base, can play a little bit of the outfield as well. There's names out there that the Yankees can get. Also, both of them, by the way, left-handed hitters, and they did a good job of mixing it up, but you just lost Rizzo, and I know he hasn't had that good of an offensive season, but he needs to be replaced by a left-handed hitter. You need to keep the balance in the lineup. I think that has a lot to do as to why their lineup is as scary as it is, and it's completely aside from Juan Soto. I think the balance of lefty-righties and Oswaldo Cabrera being the switch hitter there has shown that this team should have done this 6 years ago, and they didn't, but here we are now. So Cashman's foot's got to be on the pedal, and he's got to not floor it, but he's got to pick it up a little bit and shift over into the left lane and really start passing these teams and not be complacent when it comes to this deadline. But speaking of deadline, the Yankees got a semi-trade deadline acquisition. Definitely an area in which they personally don't think that they need to go out and get for the first time in God knows how long, and that's the starting pitching. Gerrit Cole comes back, and I thought he was pretty decent. They did not have a long leash on him whatsoever. He threw 62 pitches in 4 innings. He gave up 3 hits, 2 earned runs, 5 strikeouts, 1 walk. It's a very respectable first start out. But Evan, I'll go to you first here. If you saw him, I'm not sure if you watched the game last night, but I bet you've seen what he did by this point. What kind of confidence do you have in Gerrit Cole? What can you expect from him moving forward? Are we going to get 2023 Cy Young Gerrit Cole? What did that start say to you?
I think we're getting very close to that. And Gerrit Cole is just poised and the most hardworking pitcher player in the league, in my opinion. I mean, you see him after a good start, you see him after a bad start, and he has the same locked in face, the same persona. He never wants to come out of a game. I know you saw him annoyed in the dugout once he was taken out and runs were given up in his name, earned runs. But besides that, during the game, I know he let up that one run, a couple of doubles in the first. You know, that's a guy coming back from injury, playing the Baltimore Orioles lineup, totally fine in my book to give up one run. I know that second run was also attributed to him, I believe, pitched a little bit under five innings, but I really liked what I saw from him velocity-wise. We know Gerrit Cole really relies on that 95 and up fastball that he throws right around your chest and neck area, and I really love when he strikes batters that way because it's just so old school. He's just coming right at hitters, and as a Yankee fan, I love to see it, but that was there. He was throwing 96, 97, up in the zone, putting sliders down, putting splitters down there. So especially his circle change, I think, looked really well, which is a Gerrit Cole staple. So I think his velocity, his break was there, and especially against the Orioles, to only let up, I believe it was two runs. I know it was definitely one run, but to only let up a couple of runs in his start, first start back, only got to around 60 to 70 pitches. We know he can easily do more than that. We see Gerrit Cole touch 100 pitches all the time. Just Aaron Boone being careful on him, but I have all the confidence in the world for Gerrit Cole coming back right now.
And like, I'm fine with them being careful with him. Like, I know, Will, you know, you and I were talking. I think we were both like, huh, like, it would have been nice to see him come out for the fifth inning. That would have been cool. And especially in that game, like, who knows if that game goes differently if he comes out for the fifth. But I think the more I marinate and sit on it, like, long term, his health is the most important thing. And if that means that his first game back, he's capped at four innings and 60 to 70 pitches, so be it, because he's shown you, in my mind, nothing the last 3 years, really ever since, if you think back the 2021 playoffs and he was pitching through that hamstring, ever since then, to me, he's shown me nothing but consistency. And I have the utmost trust in him to get back to, whether it's Cy Young caliber or whether it's really, really good starting pitching, like, I feel like I know what I'm going to get from him. And so it's awesome that we're here mid-June and I haven't felt I haven't said things like, man, I really need Gerrit Cole back in the rotation. It was this really awesome thing of like, hey, it'll be awesome when we get Cole back, but we don't need it. And so it's this really sick cherry on top that I think even allows you, takes the pressure off of rushing him back and stuff like that and amping him up all the way, where it's like, all right, if we need to be slower with Gerrit Cole, it doesn't feel like the urgency is there as much, which is awesome.
Yeah, it's definitely really nice. I think they can take their time with him, absolutely, because the pitching, the starting pitching specifically outside of today, has been the best in Major League Baseball. Now,
I'll ask you, Will, are you worried about Heal? Because I was... You know, obviously today was bad. 1.1, 8 hits, 7 runs. It's the worst start of his career. Lost the strike zone, and then when he found it, he's getting crushed because they're right over the heart of the plate. And then I think if you think back to Boston, it's not his best game either. To me, like, me personally, I'm not worried per se, but maybe it is something where it's like, you know, it's really tough to be that dominant throughout a whole season, where I wonder if we're going to see maybe not even a monumental drop-off, but just a little bit of a step back in what we see from Heal on a consistent basis. Like, I hope not, but it is now back-to-back starts where you go, he's not as dialed in or locked in as we usually seen him. And then Boone made an interesting comment about his command, that aspect of his pitching is still a work in progress. Like, he's getting people on stuff. And you wonder if you get to a certain point where people see the stuff enough. Sometimes it's not enough to have stuff, right? That story gets told all the time in baseball. You have to have the intangibles. You have to be a good pitcher. Where if people catch up to the stuff, you wonder if that becomes a dip or a plateau that he has to work through.
I'm not necessarily worried about him. I think he's still going to be very effective for this entire season. But I will say this, that I did have a feeling he was kind of on cloud nine in a league of his own. I had a feeling, though, that he would get figured out. And that's what we're kind of seeing. And why is that? Because I don't think he has enough pitches yet. I think he'll put together a very solid rookie season at season's end. We may see it cut short with the innings limit. We may see a kind of role reversal for him. I would say concern. I'm not really concerned. I would say, though, that the Yankees do need to ramp Cole up in his next start. And you know, they lost Cody Petit as well to the injuries. So that's another guy that can't make these spot starts for you, on top of Clark Schmidt also being down. So you hope that next time, you know, he'll kind of puts it together now, because you're going to need it out of him. But I think what we're starting to see is that he's just getting figured out. He has three really, really good pitches, and his stuff is really good and it plays really well. But, you know, you get to a certain point in the season. We're coming up on July. Like, these hitters are starting to get really comfortable because they're all, you know, three and a half months into their normal routines. Luis Gil is in his first full major league season, still just trying to figure things out. So I wouldn't say I'm concerned, but I'm definitely also not surprised. It's not that he's bad, like, he's fantastic. He is amazing. But his age on the younger side is showing when we get to teams like Boston and Baltimore, who are going to have a little bit more of an inside edge on him because they play the Yankees so frequently. So, you know, just give him another start. This one is out of the way, but let's talk about this one today before we segue over into the Mets. This was one of the most disgusting losses I've seen in a while. Definitely the worst loss of the season so far. 17-5 against the Baltimore Orioles is just that unacceptable. It can't happen. Your game, what is it? They're a half game out now behind the Yankees. Yeah. So, you know, and to lose like this, offense wasn't even that bad today. You know, it could always be a little bit better. But, you know, you score five runs, the kind of pitching the Yankees had or have, they should be able to win that game, and they should be able to beat the Baltimore Orioles. And they're having a tough time doing that. They are having a very tough time doing that. And the Orioles starting pitching, this is what concerns me. The Orioles starting pitching is not, you know, like, marvelous. You have Corbin Burnes and you have Grayson Rodriguez. Kyle Bradish, Wells, and Tyler Wells and John Means are all out for the season and into next year with Tommy John or some reconstructive UCL surgery. The Orioles have like three starting pitchers. I don't even know who started for them today. It was Cole Irvin. Okay. Former All-Star, but the, you know, personally, not better than the three names I just read off. And he gave up five runs. You know, the Yankees hit him, but the bullpen today was the real issue outside of Luis Gil. Just the pitching in general was just really bad. And I don't know. I think all I can say about this series is that the Yankees are really showing where they stand in their own division, despite having the best record in Major League Baseball, and that the wheels need to start turning in the front office so they can create a sizable lead to secure their spot in the postseason. Because that's where I'm at with this team. That's where they need to be looking for. You're halfway to 100 wins. Get there.
Like, listen. Yeah, now you go, Evan.
And then going back to the Luis Gil thing a little bit, I think it was slightly a bad matchup. The Orioles, one of the best teams at hitting fastballs in the league, like very high up there. Luis Gil throws a fastball, one of the most in the league, also very high up there. But, you know, you don't want to make excuses like that. That goes back to only being able to rely on three pitches, the youth aspect of it. You know, if that's going to happen, you can't just not pitch a player against the Orioles. So, again, issues with that. But I really didn't like seeing, like you said, Will, the bullpen and almost this feeling that the Yankees kind of gave up as a defense almost. The relievers, we know it's an issue, but we've never seen them pitch this poorly. It just looked like lackadaisical once the Yankees were down six runs. And like you said, the offense was able to come back. I had faith in the Yankees being down six runs because of how good the offense is. So not only does it go to show how much this Yankee team needs relievers, I think it goes to show how good the Baltimore Orioles are as well. I'm really scared as a Yankee fan because you look down that lineup up and down, it's a bunch of killers. It's a bunch of guys batting over 280, young guys that look very poised. I mean, going back to the catcher thing, the second game that they lost, Jose Trevino throws a ball down to third because they even have the audacity to try to steal third there because the Yankees catchers are so bad. And it goes into the outfield on a bad throw. That results in that run scoring. And then on the other side of the ball, Oswaldo Cabrera stealing second. He should get there, but Adley Rutschman throws an absolute laser in the perfect spot to throw him out. And those are the two plays that change the game. Catcher on catcher. Now, I know we're not going to find another Adley Rutschman, but I'm just trying to say that the Baltimore Orioles are really good. And if the Yankees want to finish at the top of this division, like you're saying, Will, they absolutely need to go out and retool like we've been saying this whole time.
That was really bad too, by the way, Evan. That this Cabrera stolen base last night. Yeah. Before you go, Lou, that was, I think, what lost them the game.
Yeah.
That was just a terrible baseball decision. And I'll keep it brief. If decisions like that continue in this season, they will once again lose in the American League Championship Series. That is not a we're winning this game move. He is the go-ahead run on base with two outs in the ninth inning with the top of the order up. He will score on a base hit in the gap. He's not fast, but he's not that slow. I'm just going to say decisions like that, seen it for quite some time now. If they continue, they're not winning anything. They're just not.
I agree. And do your homework as well. I mean, Adley Rutschman, he's going to gun
best
you.
Arms like, behind the
you're
plate.
Not running against nobody.
That's a panic move, right? Because who's up at the plate? Jose Trevino, and what's the one thing that you're worried about with one out in that situation is they're thinking about the double play because that
exactly.
is Trevino hitting to a 6-4-3 double play today. So that's something that you're worried about. You know that if the ball is on the ground, that Trevino is not being in, down the line. And so you're trying to get him in motion. You're trying to steal, but like that's a panic move because you don't trust some of the guys at the bottom of your lineup. And maybe it's a little unfair because it's hard to complain about what Trevino's done offensively this season, I think, especially after you look at last year, the way it went with the wrist. The fact that you're getting 270 and a 700 OPS from him, like you sign up for that any day. And in the back of your mind, you always went, you sign up with that because of the defense. And it feels like this year, more than any other year, he never had a cannon for an arm, but it felt like everything else made up for it. And now it's starting to feel like that's not quite the case. And I think Austin Wells hasn't been the problem on this team, but he probably hasn't settled in as well as you thought. I think if you put truth serum to Brian Cashman and Aaron Boone, I think they would tell you that they would have liked that by now Austin Wells had maybe forced himself into a larger role than he is in this season. I think they'd like to see the bat get going a little more and use him have a little bit of a stronger arm behind the plate. And you just haven't seen any of that. To the Orioles standpoint, I mean, if you want to throw stats out there, 17 runs, 19 hits, 10 extra base hits, those are all season highs for them this year. You think back to Boston, like that's the rubber match where they got embarrassed in that game. Like Boston's running all over them. And my roommate Jack Warner is the first person to tell you, like, Boston's not a prolific offense. Like they've got some guys, obviously we all know what Rafi Devers can do. But up and down the lineup, that's not an offense that should scare you. But they've got speed and they did their research and they ran all over the Yankees. And Baltimore is the definition of a complete offense where, Evan, as you said, they got bats up and down the lineup. I mean, the top five in that lineup feasted today where Henderson, Rutschman, and Mountcastle, 1-2-3, they all get three hits. And then the 3-4-5 of Mountcastle, O'Hearn, Santander, Mountcastle and O'Hearn get four RBIs. Santander had three. So, right, they get guys on base right away and then they're bringing them home. And they're super fast. Like Gunnar Henderson had a field day today. But the fact that you go into two AL East series where the standings are kind of tight, these games matter. We're in June now. You win the first game convincingly. The second one's kind of a toss-up, and then you get blown out in the third. That is not a trend that should give you confidence by any means. And it's just a little alarming because I do look at Baltimore and I go, deep down, I don't know if that team, I don't know if we're better than that team, to be honest with you. And I think Baltimore is going to go get a starting pitcher. Like, whether that's Garrett Crochet, who's been awesome, or that's another starter that's on the market, you look at all the prospects that they have, like, they don't need to trade Jackson Holliday to get a really good starter. That's how deep the Orioles are in their farm system. So they can add. That's the thing that should scare the Yankees and their front office and should feed their urgency, because maybe there's even a little bit of, if we get this guy, then the Orioles can't get that guy. And I know they're not going to be in the market for a starter, so maybe it doesn't apply there. But if there's any depth position or reliever, you know, think of, like, Felix Bautista's hurt for Baltimore, so they might be in the market for a reliever. Who knows if they want to enter the postseason with Craig Kimbrel as their closer. But to have these back-to-back series, to lose the way you did in rubber matches, and then you have to turn around and play Atlanta, who I get they're not first place in the NL East, that's still a really good baseball team. I think there's a little bit of reason here to have, maybe not question the fight of the Yankees, but watching them go up against these two AL East teams that I think are maybe doing a little bit more scouting against the Yankees than the other teams that they're playing that aren't in their division, that should be an eye-opener that, all right, the teams that are really locked into beating us, they're beating us, and they're beating us in pretty similar ways.
And, they're a lot better than them, but I don't think the Mets are going to be any easier to start next week. The in-city field, recently, the Yankees have not played well. They just have not played well over the last few years or so, no matter how good or bad the Mets have been in those last few years. So another series kind of concerns me. I knew this month would be very tough for them. They still have a very tough remaining schedule up until July. This upcoming week, the Mets, then they go 4 against Toronto. So once again, a team that the Yankees are better than, but they will have the upper hand because they're in the same division. Then they play Cincinnati. Once again, not a great team, a very fast and young team that will use those legs to their advantage. But I think that's enough of the Yankees. There's still, you know, a lot of season left, but definitely some eyebrows to be raised, especially following this Boston and Orioles series. Because, and final note, those Boston losses were not particularly close. Those were games that they could have won, specifically that second game, bases loaded. Or was it Sunday? I forget. It was one of the two games. Bases loaded and nobody out. And
was the rubber match. Glaber gets a 3-0 count and ends up striking out. And then the Red Sox score all those runs and it gets ugly.
Yep. All they needed was one to go there. And it changes the whole tone of the ballgame. They stay there with a tied ballgame. And they don't do anything after then. And so Yankees are showing some weaknesses. They've come back down to earth. Still a very good baseball team. Just a rough week, but some things to definitely patch up. Let's go crosstown now, and let's talk about those New York Mets, who last time I was on Nosebleeds, it wasn't a whole lot to talk about, because it was kind of like what we were talking about with the Yankees here, just in a little bit different of a state where it was like there is no hope. But Grimace, McDonald's mascot, he brought some hope to the New York Metropolitans. 7-game winning streak ended yesterday, but still respectable loss against the reigning champs. They have played excellent baseball since Grimace threw out the first pitch. And to kind of, you know, leave the Grimace part and lore to aside, even though it's fun, all in all, great baseball. And specifically from Francisco Alvarez. And Evan, I want to jump right over to you as one of our Mets beat reporters. Hit 7 hits in this series against Texas. Had kind of a slow-ish start when he came back from the IL. The big thing I want to ask you, Evan, though, going to these games and actually seeing him there, we kind of could anticipate that the offense was going to be there. I mean, he had 2-3 hit games against Texas. The swing is coming there. But the thing that really concerned me specifically with his thumb injury is his framing and catching ability, something that he is not particularly known for, but is pretty good at it. And the kind of injury that he had definitely prohibits that, you know, excellence behind the dish. What have you seen from Francisco Alvarez behind the dish? Is he kind of over this injury? Is he good? Is he at least serviceable? What's going on defensively for Francisco Alvarez?
Well, it's actually the opposite of your worries, Will, even though they make a lot of sense for your thumb. The Mets ERA as a team dropped about 2 runs when Francisco Alvarez is behind the plate versus when they have their other catchers, Omar Narvaez, or now it's, I believe, Torrens behind the plate backing up for Alvarez. But it's been night and day when Francisco Alvarez is on the field and not in both aspects. The Mets are 18-7 when Alvarez starts, and they're 17-31 when he doesn't. So, I mean, you can see that this is a player truly making a big difference, not only behind the plate, like I mentioned, with pitchers ERA-wise. His framing is also has very good advanced stats on it, so that could be a reason for the ERA. And then runners are very more wary stealing against Francisco Alvarez. Not a fantastic arm, but they were taking advantage of the Mets' backup catchers. I mean, it was as bad as the Red Sox against the Yankees for about a month straight with the Mets in terms of opposing teams stealing on them. So that dropped down. And then behind the plate, Alvarez has been pretty good as well. I mean, the numbers aren't exactly there yet. He hasn't really gotten the power back, only one home run. Last year, this is a guy who led catchers in the NL with 25 home runs. So you expect the power out of him, but he's been shooting his average back up. It was at about 220 right when he came back. Now it's at 260. So he's been getting the hits back up. And another guy I want to bring up that came along with them is Mark Vientos. He's been such a switch for these Mets. I mean, he's batting over 300. He replaces a Brett Beatty that was playing very poorly at the plate, wasn't playing great at the field. Not that Vientos has been doing that, but Vientos batting 305 with six home runs and 895 OPS and 17 RBIs, and that's a very small sample size of games. He has been the best hitter on the team since he's been officially on the team, so that's what kind of flips the switch a little bit with Grimace. It's half Grimace, but it's also half Alvarez and Vientos themselves. I'm telling you, the Mets are, they move out of the bad and into a middle pack team when these two are in the starting lineup right now.
But I think it's funny, right? Because do I think that they're, this stretch has been awesome. And it, I think came at a right time. And you think about the way we were talking about this team 2 or 3 weeks ago, are they a World Series contender? I don't think so. I also don't think they're as bad as the vibes have been around this team for, I would say, more of the year than not, right? Because it's been a really weird thing where it's like they start off awful and then they get in these hot stretches. Like, I think this is the third hot stretch that they've had where you open your eyes and you go, hey, man, the last week or two, this team is not playing that poorly. I think most of this year been impressed by the rotation. And I know that every rotation has ebbs and flows, but for the most part, I love what Seve's done. And you look at this most recent stretch where like Quintana had a gem. Manias had a couple of really solid starts. David Peterson gave you a really solid start in that. It was a 14-2 win over Texas. That I think you have a lot of solid arm options in your rotation. Adrian Hauser is in the bullpen. He was a big part of why they lost that most recent game to Texas. But yeah, I think this team's better than people have given them credit for. Lindor heating up a little bit. I think you're getting, the numbers are starting to get to a respectable spot. Not for nothing, this is something that he's kind of done the last few years where he starts off slow. And then by the end of the year, you look at the numbers and you go, oh, hey, he ended above average with above average stats. And it just kind of stinks that it feels like every year, the first 2 months, he's a significantly below average hitter. Nimmo's been really consistent for them. Where my mind kind of goes is, all right, where is this team at? I think this team can make a wild card. I don't know how much of a postseason run they can make. And that, to me, is the big decider in how you approach this trade deadline. Because I'm still not sure whether or not this is a team that should be making major adds or even slight adds, because I still think there's value in trading some of the pieces that you have in this team if there's value there. But that decision and that all becomes a lot harder when you see runs like this and you realize, like, hey, this is a team that can make the playoffs. And not for nothing, even if you're not going to win the World Series, making the postseason is valuable. Like, I don't care what you say, even if you're not good enough to win a World Series, making the postseason is a valuable thing, especially for a team like the Mets that didn't make it last year.
I am going to stand pat on where I stand with the New York Mets, despite playing well. Bring up a great point, Lou. They've had multiple different stretches in which they've shown, like, hey, this is a good baseball team. At least offensively, I think the pitching is definitely the biggest question mark, although they've been pretty impressive for what they have. Because, when you look at the names that they've thrown out in that rotation the last few years or so, this year it doesn't even compare to what it used to be. But that offense has definitely kind of salvaged itself in a way. But like I said, I'm going to stand pat here, and I think that they should be sellers no matter where they are. I know that they are just a game out of the wild card, and that National League wild card race is very, very tight. The only two teams that aren't in it are the Marlins and Rockies, and everyone else is separated by a game and a half, I think it is, like from top to bottom, the top three, and then you have, you know, another nine teams in there that can all make it. But the reason that I'm very staunch on them selling is that I personally think the Mets can be really good in a couple of years. Like, I'm talking like winning the NL East and being an NL threat for multiple years. I really like their farm system. That's why I stand where I stand on them right now. I don't think going out and making a run this year makes a whole lot of sense. I think it would be pushy. I think it would be way too aggressive. And it would kind of feel like 2022 when they won 100 games, a very Steve Cohen-esque kind of thing to do. And I think if he really wants to make these Mets what he wants them to be, he needs to continue to build from within. And they've done a great job of doing that so far. Vientos is a direct product of that. Alvarez is a direct product of that. And I personally think they have better prospects than them in their system right now. So with all of that in mind, you still have Brandon Nimmo. You still have Francisco Lindor under contract. I still think getting rid of Pete Alonso should be a very important conversation to have, no matter how good he's been this year. I know he's the heartbeat of the Mets, and it's tough to hear if you're a Mets fan, but I really do think that if Mark Vientos is the everyday first baseman or third baseman, I know he's been getting a lot of reps as it is, but give him that position over Alonso, you'll get a big haul for Alonso because he's been very solid, and someone will pay up to get his bat, like the Chicago Cubs. Heck, even the Yankees at this point. I think you could look at that and say, hey, yo, the Yankees need a first baseman. And Pete Alonso's on an expiring contract, so it would just be a guy that he either would stay, they would sign him, or they just let him go. And they went for it this year because the Yankees are in a position to go for it this year. I just think if the Mets go for it this year, they do themselves a very, very significant disservice in terms of how good this team can be in the future. That's kind of just where I stand on the Mets. I think they've played really great baseball, but I do kind of see them coming back down to earth. They just lost yesterday, and then kind of going through another spell, and then they'll get everyone's hopes back up in late July, early August, and it'll just kind of be the same story for the Mets. So instead of, you know, being like, oh, you know, they're really good, it's like, they have really good contracts that they can get rid of. Like JD Martinez, Harrison Bader, Luis Severino, Pete Alonso. Those four guys, you can get so much for that farm system and make that farm system a top five, maybe even a top three farm system. I think even Baltimore still has a better system than them, but they could very easily put themselves in the top three farm systems in Major League Baseball. And I just think that's the direction that this team should head in, no matter how good they've been playing, to be honest.
And you know what, though? Listen, like, they can still follow this track of the ebbs and flows of the hot stretches and cold stretches and make the playoffs. Because the National League, especially, baseball in general is just not that good. There are a very few number of really good teams. And there's a lot of, to put it something, there are a lot of average mid teams that do what the Mets do, go on stretches and then go on really bad cold stretches. Like right now, the Cardinals are in a wild card spot. They were awful for the first month plus. Like we were talking about them as, oh, that's a disappointment. That's a letdown. Like we thought they could beat in the NL Central, and they were one of the worst teams in the NL Central for a minute. And now they're in a wild card spot. And the Mets were awful to start the year, and now they're in range of a couple games of the wild card. I think that they can ship off Martinez, Bader, maybe even Severino, and still make the playoffs. I think the big X factor is Alonso. I think if you give away Alonso, you're not making the playoffs. I'm I'm kind of with you. I keep going back and forth because I think if they want Alonso long term, I think you keep him. Like if you're willing to give Alonso the money, and I can't get a read on whether or not they want to, because I know he's asking for a lot of money and he's a first baseman. That's a weird position to give a guy $45 million a year to. He probably deserves a big contract. Listen, he's been their best hitter year in and year out. He's one of the most prolific hitters in the game. Either way, it helps them and their leverage to stay competitive like this. Because if they're in the hunt for a wild card spot, that gives you leverage in negotiations to go, hey, we don't have to give you Pete Alonso. Like, we can keep him and make a postseason run, and that's believable. If they fall out of the wild card race, you know, a little bit less of a leg to stand on with negotiating with those teams, and they're going, like, do we really need to give up all this for Alonso? What are you guys going to be doing this year? Like, it hurts you to keep him. But if they stay in the hunt, all of a sudden there's that plausible deniability of we keep him and make a run. Because I agree with you, Will. Like, they can ship him and, yeah, like, they can really refurbish their farm system. Like, you could get solid hauls for Harrison Bader, Severino Martinez. Like, I think Luis Severino can get you a pretty solid prospect.
I think JD can too. I think you can get two prospects for JD Martinez.
Alonso's the deal that maybe it's not Juan Soto level, and you look at like what the Nationals did when they dealt Juan Soto. That's an extreme, but maybe it's closer to that where you're getting two or three quality top 10 prospects in a farm system. Like, yeah, that changes your future a lot, and just comes down to, are you willing to part with a guy that could be a forever Met, could be a guy that 15, 20 years from now, his number's retired and hanging up there in City Field? Like, that's a conversation that they're going to have. Because I agree with you, Will. Like, I don't think this team's ceiling is any meaningful postseason success. And so that your goals are long-term, make this team as good as possible for future years. Because you have enough good contracts like Lindor and Nimmo that you'll have talent that's already there to build around, where you're not banking on hitting on a bunch of prospects. Like, the Orioles banked on hitting on a bunch of prospects, and it worked. That doesn't always happen. So you'd have a good mix of, like, all right, you'd set yourself up long-term where you hope the prospects hit and you have the established talent. That's a good spot to be in. Alonso's the one I keep going back and forth on is the right move to deal him. I think I ultimately side with you, Will, that they could get a really good package back for him, and I'm not sure that he's just in their long-term plans.
Yeah, I'm right there with you guys, especially with the Mets ceiling and this being more of a hot streak. I do want to get the Grimace stats out there because they are actually insane.
Throw them out there, Ev.
They are first in the league this past week in home runs. These are coming from Fox Sports. 13 home runs, first in the league in RBIs, 50 since Grimace's first pitch, wow. As well as second in runs, 7.4 per game, and team ERA, 2.86, and third in batting average, which was .314. They had a team OPS of .920. You can't play better baseball on either side of the ball than they were. I mean, the best pitching and hitting team for the past week. But like you guys were saying, that's for a week. That's not going to keep going. That's not who the Mets are. This was a hot streak. It was really fun. But once you get into talks about the postseason, you guys are absolutely right. You're fighting, clawing, scratching for a wild card spot because there's so many teams right there with you. It's not the Royals. It's not other teams, or not the Royals. It's not the Orioles. Other teams that know they're going to get a wild card spot if they're not going to win a division. The Mets have no chance to win their division. They have a very small chance, in my opinion, to even get that wild card spot, considering all those teams in the way. And I really agree that they have to be sellers because of what they can get back. Pete Alonso would make this so much easier on the Mets if he wasn't such a face of the franchise, if he wasn't such a good guy, if he wasn't such a fan favorite. You know, if he had a little bit of off-field problems, that would make this so much easier for the Mets because, to be honest, I love Pete Alonso, but I think he's one of the best power hitters in the league. I don't think he's one of the best pure hitters in the league. I don't think he can be the best player on a championship team, even on a deep playoff run team. I think the same of Francisco Lindor. And I agree, if you can and have the opportunity to go find those players while they're young, put them in your farm system, put them next to guys like Acuna that you already have down there in the farm system that you're already hoping to bring up alongside Alvarez and Vientos. Like you said, well, it's not easy to copy what the Orioles did, but you can mimic it as close as you can and just bring in these young guys and maybe sacrifice a season or two. But at the deadline, you're doing one of three things. You're selling, you're retooling, or you're buying. It makes no sense for the Mets to retool or bye, because they're in a position where if they do that, they're still fighting for a wild card spot. It only makes sense to sell. And I really agree that JD Martinez can absolutely be a piece of that. He's still such a good hitter, even in his old age, such a savvy veteran. Even late game, you see him all the time, smack a double, looking so composed. I know he's around mid-30s, but just last year on the Dodgers, 35 home runs, over 100 RBIs. He's on pace to have another really good season for the Mets. He could definitely go to a championship-ready team that needs another bat. And they could give the Mets a lot for that because he's playing well for them. I agree. They need to keep playing well to stay in the hunt to help these trade talks. But if you're the Mets, it's almost like the Yankees expecting Giancarlo Stanton in terms of Pete Alonso to lead your team at the plate. You can't have a pure power hitter batting 220 that strikeouts the most on your team. Although he's a very good power bat, being your lead batter, it's not a formula for success.
I will say this, though, to play the devil's advocate of the Alonso situation, is that outside of maybe like if you get a top 10 overall prospect, outside of that, you're probably pretty lucky if you get anything in return that ends up being better than Pete Alonso. It gets really hard to land a prospect that's going to end up being that good, a guy that can hit you 50 home runs. Again, he's not a complete hitter, but that is part of it when we're like, maybe he's not worth the $45 million a year or whatever that he's going to be asking for. At the same time, it can be such a crapshoot with trades. And Will, I mean, how many Yankees prospects have we heard hyped up and that we've gotten back in trade that supposed to be the next big thing and barely crack it at all in the major leagues? That it's like, man, when you get a guy like Alonso, that's just this is the devil's advocate side of it, is that it's really hard to get anything in return that's going to amount to as good of a baseball player as he is.
But the Yankees,
and I think the 45 mil has a huge part in that, because you're ultimately letting him walk if you're not going to pay that, or you're getting something back. I agree, you're totally not going to get one player as good as Pete Alonso, but maybe you're getting three that all together can add up to being the effect that Pete Alonso is, a reliever, a hitter, a starter, kind of just getting pieces and building them together instead of either paying this guy, overpaying Pete Alonso, or just letting him walk for nothing.
You know, that's another big point about Pete Alonso that I think of, is that I think the likelihood of him walking is a lot higher than a lot of Mets people want to think. I don't know how sold he is on staying with the Mets. He has Met for Life kind of written all over him, but does he have it written on him? I don't know. I really don't know. I have a lot of hesitation with that. So to what you were saying, Lou, the thing with the Yankees, where the
sorry, there's like noise outside. Heyman report, the Yankees are interested in Garrett Crochet.
I did hear about that.
Heyman just tweeted that 15 minutes ago.
I don't know how much I love that.
That will be neat.
We'll see about that. Deep in the rotation, they could. I don't think you can even move him to the bullpen at this point, because he's now a full-time starter. But I don't know. They have the pieces to move around and get him. But with the Yankees, where the Mets could end up, Aaron Judge hit. Miguel Andujar, Clint Frazier, Justice Sheffield, Dylan Tate, who is now pitching against them. Guys like that did not hit. So the Mets, though, are in a position and have the existing major league talent, like we keep saying, where some of them are going to hit. Mark Vientos and Francisco Alvarez are a good start there. Brett Beatty may end up being a Miguel Andujar. He may end up being a Clint Frazier. Luis Angel Acuna, he may hit. Jet Williams may hit. Vassell.
I like their pitching.
Christian Scott. They may hit. They may not. But they have, right? They have good names out there. They have guys that will hit, and they have guys that won't hit. And it's going to be on the evaluation of those guys. And what they should do is get these guys in, some of these guys in September after they have sold, and get them into the major league routine. So by next year, they may have a spot. And what the Mets can set themselves up to do if they trade a Pete Alonso and these other names that we've been mentioning, not only bolster the farm system, but I'll go back to the Yankees for an example. Dylan Tate went from Texas to New York for Carlos Beltran, and then went from New York to Baltimore for Zach Britton. And then by the time he came to New York, the Yankees were terrible. By the time he left New York, the Yankees were very good. The Mets can be that in like 2 years. They can have prospects that have come up, have played well, and then they'll still have a stash of guys that they can trade for major league impact guys at the 2026 deadline, and they'll be able to get those guys and surpass the Braves, surpass the Phillies, and then be really, really good. That's why I'm saying patience here is super, super important, because I think for the first time, at least in our lifetime, the Mets really have an opportunity to have a prolonged success if they do the right things with these current prospects that they have. Because they're not just ranked high, they're genuinely good baseball players, some of these prospects that they have. So I think they really need to invest more in what is in the farm system and how they can move major league pieces now to increase that farm system, then go into the next year, move those farm system pieces where applicable to the major league roster, see how that pans out, then dish off the existing farm pieces. And there you have it. You have a baseball team that will win games and not just go 7 in a row, then fall off the face of the earth, and then 7 in a row again. So Mets, very tricky spot, but like I said, I'm very Stan Pat. It seems like we're in agreement, but who knows, man? The Mets are very hot and cold. They could end up being like the 2015 Mets and do really well and get one player like Yoenis Cespedes and just go on a tear, but don't think that's the way to go. We'll just see. There's still about a month until the trade deadline, and a lot can happen in 4 weeks. But before we wrap up, let's do our general MLB, and then we have a fun little way to close out our show. We're going to do the Immaculate Draft. If you're familiar with the Immaculate Grid, this is a little bit more. This is the 2024 baseball game rage, kind of like the Immaculate Grid was last year. The Immaculate Draft, it's pretty fun, but we'll save that for just a few moments. Let's talk about the Teoscar check swing real quick. The Teoscar Hernandez check swing against the Colorado Rockies. Did you guys see that, first of all?
Okay. I saw it on social media.
Yeah. So that was a pretty crazy. I'm not going to lie. That was a very crazy call. In my opinion, he blatantly went around. And the reason I wanted to talk about it is because I kind of felt bad for the Rockies there, because the Rockies are really bad, yet they should have won that game. They really should have won that game. And another reason I wanted to talk about it too, maybe we can talk about the Dodgers for a little bit. I don't know how sold I am on the Los Angeles Dodgers. I think that they kind of were gifted that win. I know they took 2 out of 3 from the Yankees. And that was really, it was cool for Teoscar. He kind of gets away with one and then he gives them the lead. But I don't know. I'm a little concerned about the Los Angeles Dodgers. Just a little bit concerned. I want to kind of feel you guys out here though. Evan, I'll start with you first. How are you feeling about the Los Angeles Dodgers? They have a big lead right now in the NL West, but in the NL in general, how do they stack up, especially with Mookie going down?
Yeah, with Mookie going down, I mean, you can't replace Mookie Betts at all. Nobody in the league can. But I still think they stack up really well. It just, the only team that comes close after Mookie Betts is the Phillies. I know they have a better record, but I know we all can say that the Dodgers are probably a better team. It's very close, honestly. I don't know if we can all probably say that, but in terms of at least being the second best team in the NL, you look up and down this Dodgers lineup. They're 1 through 4, 1 through 5 is still stacked. They still have good pitchers. They still have good relievers. They still have Shohei Ohtani, who's nothing short of what he's been the past 3 years. This season, despite not being able to pitch, still easily one of the best hitters in the league. But this situation kind of brought to me up a little bit of why you can't challenge this call yet in the MLB. I think eventually maybe they'll put a rule in, kind of like football with pass interference, where they'll have a test season with calling, challenging it. But it seems like something with a clear boundary, you're not allowed to cross the plate or it's a strike. We have replay on both sides of the plate. We can very easily see it on cams before games, after the games, on Twitter. So they can see it pretty easily back in New York. They can see it easily wherever they are on the umpire cameras. It makes you question why they don't have the rule in place yet on whether you can challenge whether a player check swung or not. And I think this brings it into light, and I hope the MLB is looking at it at least a little bit after such an egregious play that decides the outcome of a game. And I hope they ultimately make it so you can challenge a check swing, because it only makes sense to me to be able to.
Right. There's a lot of weird rules in the MLB replay regulations and rule book. Like, I forget the one that Jake Storiali tweeted about probably a few weeks ago, where he was like, if you have a replay of it, and like we're looking at the replay of it, you should be able to challenge it. I'm wondering if it's maybe the base runner interference. Yeah, that might have been it when there was that bad one called on Soto, and then they said something about maybe it was the right call, but the rule needs to change. But yeah, that's one where it's like, and listen, I get that it's probably more of a judgment call technically than it is like, is a runner safe or is a runner out? But think about it, like the league can challenge, teams can challenge, and it's able to be reviewed, like blocking the plate and blocking the base path, which is way more of a judgment call in my book than check swing, where I think the general understanding is, hey, if that bat meets or crosses the plane, like that's a strike. And the fact that you can challenge blocking the plate, which has, I think, reached like goalie interference, pass interference level, like what is a catch, that level of thing where it's like no one knows what that is anymore. No one knows what the rule is. Every time a replay is shown, no one knows what the actual call is going to be. I think we're not there with check swing. I hope we never get there where we have to ask what is a check swing. To me, if you can challenge stuff like catcher interference, you should be able to challenge check swing. The same, like, if you can challenge hit by pitch, you should be able to challenge check swing. They're not that different in my mind.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Pass interference and goalie interference. I like you were saying, Lou, I hope that with baseball, it doesn't get to that with check swings, but it definitely has with blocking of the plate. Don't really know what it is anymore. But that brings us to our next and final MLB topic revolving around challenging. And that is the ABS challenge system in AAA. It's going from the full ABS system. So for clarity, the full ABS system is where the the umpire is told what the pitch is. It's either a ball or a strike. So it's not really like a challenge. They did that for about a week. And they're not doing it. They're going with the challenge. I forget what it's called. It's like the semi-ABS challenge. You have full and semi or whatever it is. But the challenge system that they're going with in AAA, so we're talking like knocking on the doorsteps of Major League Baseball. Now, Rob Manfred, commissioner of Major League Baseball, did say it is about a year or two away from actually being implemented into the Major League games. But what it could be is what we're seeing now, and that is the catcher and the pitcher have the ability to challenge the pitch called immediately right after. And they're doing that in AAA now. They've done that in some experimental leagues, like some of the independent leagues that Major League Baseball is affiliated with. And it seemed to be received pretty well. It's pretty interesting. You see like the tap of the helmet in some of these winter leagues, and Arizona Fall League had it. So we're going to start seeing that in AAA and potentially could see it in Major League Baseball. On the show, the podcast Foul Territory, they were talking about the manager of the Kansas City Royals, Matt Quatraro, saying that there was a floated idea out there that it may not get to this point, but there was I'm kind of blanking on it now. What was I going to? There's another way that they were going to do challenging. He didn't really have the best ideas of it, but I'll just leave it at, they've flirted with about three different ways to do this. And it seems as though the one that's in AAA could be the one that's implemented into Major League Baseball. So very briefly though, guys, Lou, I'll go to you first. How do you feel about that in general, challenging balls and strikes?
I love this system. I'm as much as it, I think it is important to get the calls right. I'm out on the completely full automatic ball strike zone, because I think, and you see some of the videos, I think what you realize is the strike zone is a little bit bigger and a little bit different than you realize when you're calling it on like whatever, like the actual grid sensor that they're using. And I think there is a little bit to it. People always talk about the human element. There is a feel to a game where, like, if it's right on the corner, like that kind of, to me, the pitcher's right on the corner, or the ones that like, borderline, is it not, like that kind of should be a 50-50. When you think about what why automatic replay was brought in, or why the ability to challenge was brought into baseball, when it first happened, the idea was like, we need to get rid of the blatant missed calls, like the Galarraga perfect game call. We're trying to get rid of those. We're not necessarily trying to get rid of the ones where we're looking at a replay for 10 minutes to see if a glove barely grazed a jersey. No, we're trying to get rid of the blatant calls that are ruining games. And to me, that's what I think about when I look at the really bad strike and ball calls that we're trying to phase out of this game. The Angel Hernandez is the CB Buckners of the world. The Laz Diaz is, we're trying to take away their ability to completely take over a game from a ball strike vantage point because they're calling these atrocious calls. Like, again, the 50-50 ones, whatever. I think there should be a little bit of gray area where either it's the feel of the game. If a pitcher's in a groove, maybe he starts to get, maybe not even half an inch off the plate, but maybe he gets that little spot off the black on a call, and that's the umpire's personalized zone or whatever. But just taking away the blatant missed calls and giving the teams in live time without the ability to look at a camera or anything, just live time, I threw that pitch. Hey, that's a strike. Let me challenge that. To me, that's the best version of this and something that I'd actually be excited to see in use in the major leagues.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I also don't want the 50-50 part out of the game. I feel like that's one of the more exciting parts of baseball. You see that pitch get thrown, you immediately look up at the umpire. You know, if you're a fan of the pitcher, he gives his strike three call, you jump out of your seat. If not, you're yelling at the TV with your dad next to you. That's just part of baseball right there. I mean, you don't want to leave that part out, wondering, will he get it right in your book? Will he get it wrong? I feel like that adds some fun to the game. And I totally agree. And I really wonder about the specifics, because it makes you think how many times they can challenge, because that'll really go into whether they're challenging balls that are clearly close or not. Is there a penalty for getting a challenge wrong? So you really have to be right. So you don't want to challenge the ones that are too close. How many do you have a game? I think the specifics are very important here, but I'm very excited to see it. And I think it's a good thing for the game to take away the umpires really controlling and doing blatantly obvious bad calls like Angel Hernandez on Kyle Schwarber or any of the Angel Hernandez compilations you watch. It's great to see that out of the game, but you don't want to see the excitement and human aspect leave.
I just remembered what it was that Cutaro was talking about, and that was the potential idea of the umpires having access to the pitch comm, so they would hear and see what it is, so they would know exactly what pitch is coming. That was like the loosely discussed idea, and don't think it's going to go anywhere, but it was discussed. That's so it is interesting. I don't really know how effective it would have been, but it was just one of the ideas thrown out there. I'm kind of with both of you guys in this sense. I love the human aspect of the game. I don't like the umpire not like just completely controlling the game. Like, that is just what they can do with the kind of ability that they have. So I like that they're limiting that. But like you're both saying, with a combination of it, the imperfections of that is what makes that the game so beautiful. Like, sometimes even if it's against you, it's something that you'll always talk about. It's like, man, that guy really messed that call up. Like, oh, remember, but if this guy called that a ball and this was a strike, if he was safe or if he was out. But, you know, I think there's a good blend, like what you're saying, Evan, if they can get to a challenge limit, how many times you can do it, what's the penalty if you are wrong. I think that they'll figure all of that out and it'll make it work, because as long as you have that, I think it'll work.
I do wonder, like, when, because I think it's now more of a case of when than if, when this technology gets to the big leagues. The first time that there's a game, like let's say it's 3-2 bases loaded, the team scores, they win the game, the team gets a strikeout, they win the game, and there's that pitch that it's called a ball, but maybe it just nicks a piece of the zone and they challenge it. The first time one of those games like gets challenged and gets overturned on a call that is just like a centimeter in the strike zone, I wonder what the reaction is going to be.
Oh yeah,
because it's always those like really close calls like that that generate the most outrage. So I'm really curious. And there's no way, if you bring a challenge system into the league, eventually one of those situations is going to happen, and that is like what you live with. But I would be excited to see and really curious to see what the talk is like when we get some of those situations and how often those situations might come up. Because especially late game, if you got a challenge in the back of your pocket, why wouldn't you use it?
And I think that's the very, the most intricate part of it, because I remember, if I remember correctly, Starling Marte, when he was with the Pirates, actually was responsible for the first win courtesy of a challenge. I believe there was a sac fly and he scored, was called out. The Pirates challenged and won the game because he was safe. I think a ball strike call may actually have a lot more reaction and importance than a sac fly and the runner being called out, then overturned to being safe. I think the ball strike may actually have a lot more pull than that. But that's going to do it for all of our discussions for Major League Baseball, our locals, and of course the passing of the great Willie Mays. But let's end on a fun note here. We're going to play the Immaculate Draft. It's pretty simple. You go Immaculate. 9 for 9, the Immaculate Draft. It's immaculate. 9 questions, immaculate. 9 correct answers. That's really good stuff. Let's get it going. So just to explain a little bit of the rules before we get into it, there's 9 questions. Like I said, you have to get the answer right. And each time you get the answer right, your increase in overall player selection goes up. So when you get a question right or wrong, you get an option of 3 players. And you have to choose one of those players to build the best possible team that you can get based on what you just get from right answers, what you get from wrong answers, whatever the case may be. It's a lot of fun. It's been kind of getting more and more popular as the summer goes along. But are you guys ready to do some immaculate drafting?
Let's do it, babe.
All right. Let's just get the screen record going.
Yeah.
And we're money. Okay. First question of the Immaculate Draft from June 20th is, what position did Willie Mays play? Center field, right field, left field, third base, shortstop. I think center we field. All know the answer. Center field. All right. Rough start. We're going to take an 80 Kurt Suzuki. Not even going to say the other names because they were silver cards. It's not happening.
There's always a barren position. That's why you start with.
Exactly. Let's go over to first base now. It's a Willie Mays themed draft for today. Once again, rest in peace to the Say Hey Kid. With what team did Willie Mays finish his MLB career with?
That'd be the Mets.
Will be the Mets, no doubt whatsoever. 81 Chris Davis.
Hey.
Nice.
That was the best
three
one.
Home run hitter.
It's power in that lineup.
50 plus home run season as well. I remember correctly. How many all-star appearances does Willie Mays have? Now, keep in mind, he played in an era where they had 2 all-star games.
It's 24,
right? Yeah, 24. Yeah, I saw the stat earlier. 24.
And I think we said at the beginning of the show because we're like that.
Absolutely. Placido Polanco, 83 overall.
Take that.
Shortstop, which award is named after Willie Mays? Oh, I don't know. I actually don't know this one. We have Rookie of the Year, which is definitely not it. That's Jackie Robinson. NL MVP, World Series MVP, Gold Glove, Silver Slugger. I'm going to rule both of those out. Something is telling me.
I think it's
World
NL
Series
MVP.
Is it NL MVP?
I don't know.
I think he won a World. I don't think he did. He win a World Series MVP?
Win a World Series MVP, but he won a World Series.
Yeah, he won a World Series, no MVP.
Won 2 NL MVPs.
Yeah.
I think Let's we go. Go. I think it's got to be NL MVP then, right?
Gotta be.
Let's lock it in. It's World Series MVP.
I'm sorry, Will.
See, but I get the logic, though. Something was telling me it may have been that, but I get the logic as to why we didn't go with it, because he never won the award.
He did win a World Series MVP, didn't he?
I don't think in 54, no. That was the I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think he did. That was the only World Series he won.
Yeah, so
we got a 74 Yunel Escobar, a 71 Yankees Eduardo Nunez, and a 73 Nico Goodrum. We got to go with Yunel Escobar, right?
Let's say Yunel.
Yunel Escobar.
Guy.
He was really good for a short period of time.
Yes.
Former third base. How many MVPs has Willie Mays won? I think it's two. Yeah.
Two.
11 years apart. Don't think anyone has actually done it since him. We'll go with two, and we're correct. Ooh, 88, Austin Riley. Now we're starting to cook a little bit. We need to get these last four.
Cooking with gas.
Love it. What number did Willie Mays wear? That's 2-4. It's 24, for sure. Yeah. 91, Bryce Harper. We got our first diamond. He's on the board.
And how much? What was the percentage of correct answers on that?
I didn't even look. I just went for the Bryce Harper.
Gotta be high.
It's gotta be. It's a Willie Mays themed draft. These gotta be high percentage answers, I think. What nickname was Willie Mays commonly known by? The Say Hey. We'll make sure we look at the percentage. 95% answered correctly. Carl Crawford, 82 overall.
He's gotta be a higher over Carl Crawford in his day. Was a stud with the Rays.
Disrespectful.
It's unbelievable baseball player. Center field, we have two questions left. Willie Mays is famously known for making a spectacular over-the-shoulder catch in the 1954 World Series. What is the name given to this iconic play?
Isn't it just the catch?
I think it is. That's the answer. The catch, the final out, the game saver, the grab, the basket out. I've never heard of the basket out.
It's the catch.
It's the catch.
It's got to be the catch.
We're locking it in. The catch.
Nice.
That is correct. And we're taking 82 overall, Brett Gardner.
Yes.
Bang.
That's awesome.
My mom's
last question. Let's see if we can go 8 for 9. Willie Mays served in the military during his career. In which conflict did he serve? I'm going to go with... So we got World War II, Vietnam, Gulf War, Korean War, Cold War. I'm going for Korean War just because he debuted in the early 50s.
It's definitely not World War II.
It's definitely not. It's definitely not the Cold War.
I don't think it's Vietnam.
Yeah, Vietnam was like late 60s.
I think it's Korea too.
We lock in the Korean
War. I'll rock with Korean.
It's either that or Gulf. Got to be Korean.
Let's go with the Korean War. And that is correct. We're taking 82.
We will.
Come on.
Alex Rios. We finished with an 82 overall. We got Kurt Suzuki, Chris Davis, Placido Polanco, Yunel Escobar, Austin Riley, Bryce Harper, Carl Crawford, Brett Gardner, Alex Rios as our team. I really love that because with the exception of Bryce Harper and Austin Riley, we grew up watching all of those other seven guys. Like Alex Rios,
that's great.
6'6" for no reason, and he was a stud. He was awesome.
Some really good. The overalls, I think, were a little insulting, but we got some really good from our generation growing up baseball names, which is what it's all about.
Absolutely. Underdogs.
Well, I think we're
surprising a lot of people.
We got gypped a little bit, man. I know the percentages of the questions were a little easier. We went 8 for 9, and we got, what was it, 82 overall was our team?
Yeah, 82 overall with one diamond being a 91 Bryce Harper.
I think we got gypped a little bit.
I do too. I think we did too. We started with an 80 overall. That's always like...
You know what? But the catcher overalls are always low.
They are. They are usually pretty low. Unless you get Pudge Rodriguez. I haven't seen Johnny Bench. I've never gotten
an 81 overall at catcher.
So there you go. Well, guys, it was a lot of fun. It was a little bit of a longer episode, but we were talking ball. Nothing better than talking ball at this hour of the night. Gotta love it. Always a blast, boys. And to wrap it up for Lou Orlando and Evan Harkin, I'm Will Talent, and this was Nosebleeds, a production of WFUV Sports. Mm-hmm.